details about the police response to the Parkland shooting, the talk of teacher pay, and a new Cuban leader who's not a Castro. Welcome to the Florida Roundup this week on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. New details continue emerging about the first response during and immediately after the school shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School, including a judge's order now to release more surveillance video. With teachers striking in several states for higher pay, two big school districts here in South Florida have talked about it. The teacher union leaders for Miami-Dade and Broward County teachers will join us. Plus, the new boss in Cuba, same as the old one? He's not a Castro, but what does Cuba's new president mean for the island and relations with South Florida? All that with your phone calls and tweets coming up on the Florida Roundup next on WLRN after the news. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. The drip of details about the police response in the first minutes of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting continue to come out this week, and more will be coming. A Broward County judge ordered the release of surveillance video from just outside the school. Audio from Coral Springs Parkland fire responders and a report from a Margate off-duty SWAT officer who responded add more evidence to the confusion and the delay in entering the building where the shooting happened. What do you need to know? What do you want to know about the continued information that comes out about that law enforcement response on February 14th? 800-743-WLRN. It's where we will begin this Florida Roundup with your phone calls at 800-743-9576. In the meantime, some students are protesting today, the 19th anniversary of another mass school shooting, this one in Columbine, Colorado. Alex Wind is one of the student leaders at Stoneman Douglas.
This started with Columbine in 1999, and it's been 19 years. It's been way too long since anything has changed. It's transitioned from Columbine to now Stoneman Douglas. We have one commonality between us, which is this terrible tragedy that has happened to both of our schools, and we need to show that we stand together.
Stoneman Douglas student Kyle Kashev organized a live stream event today he called Walk Up, Not Out. Kurt Schlichter is a columnist for the conservative website townhall.com. He was the first speaker on the live stream.
When someone abuses it, when someone commits a horrible crime, that's a terrible thing. And it's easy to say, well, you know, if they didn't have the ability to commit this crime, why, this crime wouldn't happen. That's an error because it involves the violation of a natural right. Natural rights are important. They're what make us a free people.
We will begin with the student walkout, student protesting here on this 20th of April here on the Florida Roundup. Again, your phone calls, 800-743-9576. WLRN's Jessica Bakeman was at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland this morning. She joins us here on the Roundup. Jessica, tell us, what did you hear from students, teachers, and faculty?
Well, a group of teachers actually gathered in front of the school this morning at 7 o'clock before school because obviously they were not going to be able to walk out of school during the middle of their work day, but they wanted to show the students they supported what they were doing and have their voices heard as well. So there were about two dozen of them. They were waving signs and talking not only about the need for gun control in their opinion and, you know, school safety, of course, but also broader issues about public education, that there needs to be additional funding. Obviously, we've heard a lot of criticism of the legislature's budget this year, in that it had, you know, money for mental health funding and school safety, but not much for, you know, general educational resources. So they were protesting about that as well. And then later, at about 10 o'clock, a few dozen students walked out of Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. We heard from some students that, you know, the principal had said if they left the school, it would be an unexcused absence. And I guess there were opportunities for the students to organize and have a moment of silence inside the school and, you know, sign a banner for Columbine there without leaving. So I guess some decided to do that. And then a few dozen, like I said, left the school. They walked just a tiny bit down the street to a nearby park. It's very close.
Right.
And a couple of people were carrying a big banner, and when they got to the park, they unfurled it on the floor of the gazebo, and it said, "Never again," and it had red footprints, and all of the kids took turns signing it, and they said that they're going to send it to Columbine.
Now, if memory serves right, the principal, as you mentioned, was encouraging the students to do some volunteer work today in this remembrance of the Columbine tragedy 19 years ago, not to do a walkout. Do those students who did step off campus face any repercussions?
I'm not sure if they're facing any repercussions. And as for the volunteer work, you know, a lot of the kids I talked to who did walk out said that they plan to spend the rest of their day doing some volunteer work. Yeah. I guess that is the tradition that they started in Columbine. Mm-hmm. They have the day off there for the anniversary, and the kids there typically do a day of service. So they were some of the kids here were saying that they were going to do that as well.
WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman in Broward County today. Jessica, thank you for your time here on the Florida Roundup. I want to bring in Stephen Hobbs, a reporter, investigative reporter with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. He joins us via Skype here on the Roundup. Stephen, welcome back. What's the latest that we've heard this week in a series of different kinds of reports coming in from different types of law enforcement agencies regarding more evidence about the response that was on display on February 14th at Marjorie Stoneman? What has begun to kind of be woven together here?
Well, Tom, thanks for having me back on. We learned some new information about some of the confusion that officers had on the scene that day. It's expected there's always going to be confusion, but one of the things that we learned this week from a Margate officer who filed a report about his response that day was that he and some other officers received some information. We're not really sure from whom or you know where they got this, that it was possible that a gunman might have been in the administrative offices mm-hmm. or building, which is on the southeast side of the campus, so away from the 1200 building where the shooting actually took place. So that was just kind of the latest in another fact and kind of a piece of a puzzle to give us an idea of what officers were thinking that day and where they were being sent to and what leads they were trying to follow in real time.
Among the big questions that continues to remain is why the first responding officer, the school resource officer, didn't engage with the gunman in the building as soon as possible and to go in. Does the evidence that has come out in the last 7 or 10 days, are we any closer to an answer about that question or, for that matter, the circumstances around what that school resource officer was experiencing?
Not really in regards to school resource officer Scott Peterson, but we did get some more reports into some other sheriff's office deputies who were responding as they say as the gunshots were going on. There was at least three that said that they heard gunshots when they were, you know, arriving at the school, and it seems like they were all unsure of where the gunshots were coming from. Some people thought it was at the football field or around that area, which is just to the west of the building. So it just sounds like that the people who were there were just really not sure. And that is similar to what Deputy Peterson said as well. And kind of his response was that he wasn't sure.
Talking with Stephen Hobbs via Skype, Stephen is investigative reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. More information coming out about the initial law enforcement response to the Stoneman Douglas shooting on February 14th. Mark is calling in from Coconut Grove. Mark, thanks for holding on. Your thoughts on this?
Thank you. Good morning. I just wanted to point something out from a very pragmatic point of view, that we as a society have this unusual view of police officers akin to superheroes, when in fact they're human. They're humans with the same driving forces that all the rest of us have. And we have to keep this in mind, that an officer doesn't actually have, and I could be wrong, and I'll accept any challenge to this, that they don't have any contractual requirement to put their life in danger to save somebody else. They don't have any legal requirement to do it. It's basically up to them to assess the situation and decide whether they're going to put their life in danger or not. And people have to remember that. You are responsible for your own safety. Fantastic if it's an officer's there, but they're not responsible for your safety.
Well, it's an interesting perspective, Mark. You know, what we heard in the days after the shooting, Mark, as you remember, and Stephen, I know you know this from the Broward Sheriff, Scott Israel, when he disclosed the inaction by the school resource officer to engage immediately with the shooter. The Broward sheriff said, you know, find the shooter, kill the shooter, to serve and protect. And that kind of engagement has been seen as pretty standard protocol training when it comes to active shooting. We also got a development this week out of the court system where a Broward County judge has ordered the release of some surveillance video that had been in question, Stephen. What do we know about this judge's order and when we could see the surveillance video and what it may show?
Yeah, there were two things that were the judge had to consider here. One was the state attorney's office said that the investigation was ongoing and they didn't want this video to be released. What it is about video from five security cameras around the general area looking for the police response. And so he viewed that and said, this doesn't really put into problem the ongoing investigation into Nicholas Cruz, whether or not he was the gunman and the shooter in the school. Secondly, the school board had argued that by releasing any of these cameras, angles and video from them, it could possibly be a problem for the security mm-hmm. of the school, or that people might know where they are. The judge also ruled that the information, the questions about the response outweighed that concern. So now the judge said there's a stay on this decision until early May 2nd. The school board can challenge this decision, appeal it, and if they don't by May 2nd at noon, then the video will be released.
All right,
by
so
the
it
sheriff's office.
Could be about 10 days or so away, depending upon the action of the school district. Stephen Hobbs joining us via Skype, investigative reporter for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Thank you so much, Stephen, for sharing your reporting with us today on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you again, Tom.
Plenty more to come here. Public school teacher pay is up next. There's talk about the potential pay hikes in South Florida. The leaders of two of the teacher unions will join us next. Your thoughts on teacher pay, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, as the roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. Teachers in Arizona are just the latest to vote to walk out over a protest about pay. Teachers in Oklahoma, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Colorado have all protested their paychecks in recent weeks. Now, this week, the Broward County School Board floated the idea of a property tax hike, maybe, to hike teacher pay. A similar idea has been talked about in Miami-Dade County. Palm Beach County schools say there's no money for raises because of the requirement to spend any new state money on school security and mental health services. The Florida Education Association, that's the statewide teachers union, has called on lawmakers to address school funding if they hold a special session in Tallahassee to deal with gambling. Are public school teachers in Florida adequately paid? What would you like them to be paid? And would you support a tax increase if the money goes toward teachers' pay? Leslie Barrio teaches 4th and 5th grade math and science. After 12 years of teaching in Miami-Dade County, she says she brings home about $45,000 a year. That does not include any extra work she does, though, on the side, like being the chair of the math department or managing the after-school care program and more.
We would just like to see our years of service and experience have a little bit more value.
Rosa Douglas in The Crossing told us that she lives in Miami-Dade County, and she would definitely support such a tax hike here as long as the money is actually going to the teachers. Tyson in Miami Beach sent us this text. Absolutely. As a former educator who left because it was financially not feasible, I understand how difficult it is for teachers to afford living in South Florida. And this is Dan Singleton, who lives in Davie.
I totally support that tax increase if, of course, the money will go towards teachers' pay. You know, our teachers, they're such an extremely valuable resource, and our children, honestly, are our future. I don't think there's any more valuable resource. My wife, Joan, you know, she used to teach middle school in Key Largo, and she also taught in New York and Virginia. Guess whose pay scale is the lowest? You got it, right here in Florida.
How about your voice on teacher pay? 800-743-WLRN, the telephone number. Are teachers adequately paid and compensated in your community? Do you think they deserve more money or a difference in their paycheck? 800-743-9576. Yuri in Glenvar Heights sent us this text. No, the taxes never go where intended. The lottery was supposed to do that. Let's move lotto money to teachers instead. Moreover, home taxes have gone up at an accelerated rate. Yuri writes us those funds were supposed to go to schools and teachers. And Denarius says that public school teachers are extremely well paid, especially considering how terrible public school students are performing. Well, the leaders of two of the teacher unions here in South Florida are with us now. Anna Fusco is the president of the Broward Teachers Union, and Carla Hernandez-Matz is the president of United Teachers of Dade. Anna and Carla, thanks so much for your time here today on WLRN. Anna, let me begin with you. When you hear talk about the school board potentially floating the idea of tax rate for teacher pay, how do you hear that?
Well, we're definitely taking it in. We received it, and we're, you know, putting some research into it. We know that our state legislation took a really big slap on us of cutting all kinds of funding and mandating the new Stoneman Douglas Marjorie Safety Act without putting in the proper funding for it is another big hit. There are so many needs out there to make sure our public education is funded well, but they don't want to fund it.
You're talking about cuts to funding from the state? The state, as far as I know, didn't cut funding for education.
Well, when you mandate more things and you don't add in the money to fund those mandates, that's a form of a cut.
So you're defining that as a cut. Gotcha. Carla, you have heard the talk in Miami-Dade County about the possibility of even a tax referendum to voters on money that could go to teacher pay. What kind of support have you seen gathering around that?
Well, we've actually seen a lot of support. We've been talking to teachers and, of course, community members, especially with, the March for Our Lives. And, you know, everyone's talking about what's happening in public education. And we see what's happening nationwide. So I thank you for bringing that to the forefront. I mean, certainly we see that this is not an epidemic that's happening here locally. This is something that's happening nationwide when we talk about Oklahoma and, of course, West Virginia and Kentucky and Arizona. And what we see here is that, you know, politicians are not telling us the truth about education funding. You know, our schools are underfunded and it's harming our kids. And so we need to stand up for our kids. We need to support public education. And when our state legislature does not do what it's supposed to do, when it does not provide a robust funding system for public education who serves more than 90% of all children in our community, it is harmful and it is shameful. And we need to call them out for doing that. And so if there is a special session, which I know that they're tinkering that idea. They certainly need to talk about public education and about putting adequate funding into public education.
Let me ask you, both of you, would you support a tax referendum, an increase in property taxes that would go toward teacher pay in either Broward and in Dade County? Anna, you first.
Yes, we are definitely weighing on the side of supporting it. We know that because of the money that's not there from the state, and our teachers need to be paid better for the job that they're doing and the excessive amount of mandates that are put on them, and they work well outside of their working hours on the regular day, regular week, throughout the year, including summers, and actually time off that everybody considers that they have between winter and spring breaks. They're doing all types of extra work, so yes, we would be in support.
You would be in support of it, and I will note that both school districts, Broward and Dade County, in the last several years have had voter-approved referenda for capital improvements, $1.2 billion in Miami-Dade County, $800 million in Broward County, so $2 billion total between the two counties. Carla, how about for United Teachers of Dade? Are you in support of a higher property tax in Miami-Dade County for teacher pay?
Absolutely. I think it's the right thing to do because, unfortunately, we know that our state legislature is not doing what it's supposed to do. Citizens in Miami-Dade, they pay a great deal of property taxes, which is being, you know, redistributed throughout the state to fund other districts rather than being invested back into our community. Currently, we only get back $1 out of every 10 that is generated. And when we talk about Florida
for education,
as a whole,
for just to be clear, Carla,
for education. Absolutely.
Right. That has to deal with the state funding formula, right?
Yes. And when we talk about Florida as a whole, you know, and look at it through the national perspective, you know, we always fall below the national average, and we are the fourth largest state in the country.
The third largest state. We actually crept ahead of, I think it was New York a couple of years ago.
Oh, well, all right. Let me put that in my notes. And so, you know, when we take all of those things into consideration, you know, and we look at how much, you know, New York, for example, you know, spends on base student allocation in terms of funding public schools. I mean, you know, there's a huge gap. And we're just not doing what we need to be doing here in terms of investing in children.
Each of you are joining us from Tampa, from our sister station, WUSF. You're in Tampa for a meeting of the Florida Education Association. You saw just here on this Friday, Arizona teachers vote for a potential walkout that could begin over the next couple of weeks. We've seen walkouts in West Virginia and Oklahoma, Kentucky. Would you support public school teachers in your unions in Broward County, Anna, and in Dade County, Carla, walking out?
So that's a touchy and tricky situation, and I'm going to explain why. So in some, so every state has different laws,
right? And I understand, and there's some laws, and there's right to work, and I understand that, and there's some things you can do and can't do, and I get that. But what I want to hear though is just is that a tactic that you would utilize if so deemed appropriate or necessary?
If it was appropriate and necessary, absolutely. I would hope that we could get there. We could get to a better situation before having that kind of tactic. I think that even having these conversations about a possible referendum or asking our state legislators to go back into a special session, those are all things that need to be taken into account before we impact our community in that manner.
Anna, your thoughts on the potential of a walkout? Is that something that you'd still want to keep in your quiver?
Our potential of organizing together and standing as one voice of expressing what our needs and wants are and getting them, the actual of a walkout or a strike is prohibited in Florida state statute. We don't ever want to encourage anybody to do something that would harm their career, their future pension, their certificates, as many might think that if 15,000, 18,000 get up and walk out, that our state would impose severe consequences and possibly termination. And that is the reality of it. We do not stand behind that type of action when it can lose many people's careers. But standing together on demanding the needs and wants that we have is definitely an option. But going forward on talking about some type of way we can go about getting it, of the special session that's possibly happening April 23rd, and putting in our needs and demands and seeing if they're going to go forward. That's a first, and definitely working with our communities and our local, our district superintendents to ask for going to the community and this asking of a tax. That's definitely a first.
But, you know, if I could also interject and add something to the conversation, I mean, one of the things that is not really talked about a lot in our local media or statewide either is, you know, one of the bills that was passed this session was to decertify teachers' unions.
Correct.
And
that's
so
right.
we see
but,
that.
But just to be clear, the legislation doesn't automatically decertify teachers' unions. There's other actions that have to happen. Teachers actually would essentially make that decision by not participating, by deciding not to participate in the union.
Well, that's an arbitrary number. So we can talk about the legality and constitutionality of them even, you know, putting that up on a bill when our state constitution specifically says that we have the right to collective bargain.
Right.
You know, and we know that these legislators were not, this is an arbitrary number. These legislators were not even voted on, elected by 50% of their constituents. So for them to bring this number up, it shows you the intent, which is to really dismantle public education, take away the working rights, you know, our voice, strip us from our rights so they can continue to defund public education and bring us to that brink where everyone else in these other states, when you see that teachers in Oklahoma have not had a raise in 9 years, they should be ashamed of that, you know. And
so we got some phone calls here. Carla Hernandez Matz is along with us. That was her just speaking, president of the United Teachers of Dade. Anna Fusco is the president of the Broward Teachers Union, talking about teacher pay here in South Florida, as teachers in Arizona have voted to walk out. We've already seen teachers in Oklahoma and West Virginia walk out of classrooms. Kentucky and Colorado have been involved in this, talking about teacher pay, teacher pay hikes in the last union contracts in South Florida. Average pay increases about 2.5% or so. Your phone calls now, 800-743-9576. Are teachers adequately compensated in your community, do you think? Are you willing to pay more in property taxes to increase teacher pay? 800-743-WLRN. We'll begin in Palmetto Bay, where Lisa has been patiently hanging on. Lisa, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question. First of all, teachers do a wonderful job. Thank you very much. But when you're talking about your average pay, is that net? Is that gross? Second, does that take into account the benefits such as medical pay and, most importantly, a pension where you only pay a very small part into it and it's funded by the taxpayers? That's it.
Gotcha, Lisa. We'll tackle the first part of that question, which is gross or net. The example of the teacher that we played, Lisa Barrio, teaches fourth and fifth grade math and science. She talked about earning $45,000 a year after 12 years of teaching. And Carla Hernandez Matz, I have the salary schedule for 2017-2018 for Miami-Dade County. And here it is, years of experience, 12 or 13 years of experience. The base pay is $44,690.
Yeah.
That's a gross number. That's not net. That's not take home. That's a gross number.
I think that, the questions that she's asking, obviously she wants to know about benefits and everything else. I mean, we have lost 3% to our retirement system because now we have to, support the retirement system, which was a very healthy retirement system.
So let me unpack that a little bit. So what you're saying, it's not that you've lost 3% of retirement. What you're saying is that 3% of teacher pay now is contributed to the retirement plan as opposed to being in the take home pay.
That's correct.
That's correct. Okay.
We also haven't seen an adjustment for inflation in almost 2 decades.
In
base pay.
Isn't that a failure of contract negotiating then? I mean, the pay increase that in Dade County was about 2.6% in the contract that teachers are teaching under this year. And in Broward County, it was 2.6% pay increase. Inflation was roughly 2% last year nationally.
Right. But when you talk about decades, right, almost 2 decades of the same type of adjustment or lack of adjustment, then really what we see is that teachers in Florida have actually seen a 6% decrease in salary since 1999-2000 school year.
Gotcha. So it hasn't kept up with overall inflation. What about the pension question, Anna? What about the teacher pension question from Lisa in Palmetto Bay?
About that we supposedly play minimally into it. Remember, our government without any type of bargaining, without any ask, just imposed an extra 3% out of our salaries.
So, again, that's a 3% contribution on the part of salaries for public teachers.
From our base pay.
Right. 3% where it had been 0%, correct?
Right.
Right. I think the question Lisa's asking is about what's at the end of that? What does that look like at the end of it? Yes, you're now being asked to contribute 3% of the pay, but what does that pension look like at the end, at retirement?
That's a good question. We don't know what it's going to look at the end because things seem to change every year.
All right.
We're hoping that it stays intact and at the end of our 30 years of service that we have a solid pension that obviously from contribution that's part of our package, but also from the mandated of our contributions from our own salary.
Right.
But I will say this in a very simple term. Obviously, it's not enough. I mean, when you have other media outlets saying that they are proposing to have housing on campus for teachers.
Right. We've heard that for Miami-Dade, yeah. And for Monroe County, too.
Exactly. So it shows you that, first of all, we don't make ends meet so that we can live in the communities that we serve.
We've got some teachers on the line here. Sorry to interrupt, but we want to talk to some of your constituents as well. Sandy in Miami tells us she's a teacher on line 4. Sandy, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Yes. I'm concerned about funding not being given to the district so that we can get the proper raises that we need. I want to know what's going to be done so that we can get public education funded so that teachers can get salaries and stop giving so much money to charter schools that don't accept our kids when they don't want to.
Yeah. Looking for funding opportunities and alternatives there. Sandy, a teacher in Miami. Catherine, a teacher in Pinecrest. Catherine, you're on the radio. Thanks for holding.
Hi, good afternoon. First of all, I'm a union member with Miami-Dade, and I want to thank Ms. Carla for everything that she's done for us. But I wanted to explain my situation. I've been working for over 12 years for the system, and I essentially make less now than I've ever made before.
Is that take-home pay? Catherine, sorry to interrupt, just your take-home pay. Okay.
Yeah, my take-home pay is essentially the same as when I first started. I paid out to get my master's degree. I've always had high performance evaluations, and I just feel like, although our superintendent deserves a lot of credit for, you know, sticking up for teachers, I'm not sure I understand why there's so much resentment against teachers. I mean, is it because we're women, or, you know, policemen and firefighters get all the accolades, but teachers, you know, we're told like we're less than nothing.
Catherine, where do you feel that resentment is coming from?
I think it's against unions. I think it's absolutely a movement against unions, and they just, anybody that brings up union, you know, union talk, then they all of a sudden think you're a heretic or a communist or whatever. But the fact is, the union has protected us. There wouldn't be the reward of teaching the way that we have it now had it not been for our union.
Catherine,
and
I hear you.
UCD.
I want to squeeze in a couple of more phone calls here with our union leaders. Marcus in Miami has some alternative ideas for revenue sources. Go ahead, Marcus. You're on the radio. Share it with us.
Hi, good afternoon. I was wondering, what about the idea of, instead of raising property taxes for all homeowners, which ultimately interferes with people's qualifying for mortgages, why not instead offer teachers a property tax exemption? This will help current teachers with more money and qualify teachers that don't have homes to qualify for more house.
Let's put it to the union leaders. Anna, Carla, what about it? A property tax exemption above and beyond what's currently available for all property homeowners for educators?
Well, there's a couple things with that. Lots of our teachers don't own their own homes,
right.
So there's one. And two, that's a form of, separation and segregation. It can cause, some conflict in that one. But I think one of the main reasons is that most of our teachers with a salary of, $44,000 do not own their own home.
Right. And to piggyback on what Sandy and Catherine were saying, first of all, thank you all so much for the work that you do and the service that you pay to our community. I think that Catherine was onto something when she was talking about, what the sentiment is. I mean, we know that nationwide, there's a tremendous wage gap between teachers and other public workers. One that has increased 2% from 2%, in 1994 to 17% in 2015. And so education, we know that it is just as critical or more to society than public safety, and it should be treated as such. And unfortunately, we're not getting the attention that it needs.
Are both of you in active salary negotiations right now with the school districts?
So I'll speak for myself. This is Carla.
We
are not. I mean, we have already talked about reopening our contract negotiations, but we have not set dates yet. So we will be soon.
So you're negotiating about negotiating, so to speak.
Yes.
Anna, how about with the Broward Teachers Union? Is there an active dialogue right now about the salary schedule for 18-19?
Right. There's active dialogue. And, of course, you guys have seen Broward County, all of the situations that's going on, and we're respectively trying to respect each other's time on both sides on taking care of lots of business that has been created from that unfortunate tragedy. But there is, dialogue going on what we need to go forward in and having active, fruitful negotiations. Dates have not been set yet, but the verbals happened and some of the writing has happened of picking dates.
Anna Fusco, the president of the Broward Teachers Union, along with us, and Carla Hernandez-Matz, the president of United Teachers of Dade. Ladies, thank you so much for spending part of your day with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come as the roundup continues, the new boss in Cuba, same as the old boss. It's the presidential transition on the island. Your thoughts, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLR, and I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. The historic moment cannot be denied. The first time in decades now, Castro is not the president of Cuba. But the significance may be a lot less dramatic. Cuba has a new president, yes, Miguel Mario Díaz-Canel, but former President Raúl Castro remains the boss of the Communist Party of Cuba. So do you think Cuba's next president will bring any change to the island? This is where we pick up the Florida Roundup now, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 to join the conversation. Robert in Miami sent us this text. The new Cuban head of state is going to be constrained by the hardline old guard, both in Cuba and in Miami. He continues, ironically, these enemies are both working in the same direction against any opening or change in Cuba. Marie in Miami, change, she texts us. Really more of a photo op. I was blessed to come to the U.S. at age 4 over 58 years ago, purposely have not been back. I cry for my birth country for over half a century of torture, but I doubt there will be ever be change in the system. It's now ingrained into the culture. And Chris in Hollywood sent us this. If there's any change expected, it will have to come from the Cuban people, both in Cuba and in Miami. Chris continues, there are plenty of tightly held beliefs on both sides that are a hindrance to any change. You can add your voice, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We're joined by Tim Padgett, who covers Cuba and the Latin America hemisphere for us here at WLRN. Nora Gámez-Torres, a reporter for El Nuevo, Miami Herald. And Patrick Oppmann is the Havana correspondent for CNN with us on the island. And Patrick, let me begin there here. The first full day of this new president who's not a Castro. Tell us, what are you hearing on the streets of Havana? What have you heard both in the corridors of power and on the streets?
Well, as it happens in Cuba, I'm watching the speech being retransmitted. I've lost count how many times it's already been shown since yesterday. I think it's going to go on probably through at least the weekend, so everyone will eventually see it. You know, leading up to this, there was not a lot of excitement about it. Cubans now, if they've seen the speech or heard it on radio, realize that something different has happened, if not quite something new, and they're trying to parse what it all means. The speech, Miguel Díaz-Canel's speech, was shown throughout the island, but it really his audience was the front row of the National Assembly there yesterday, the historic generation, some of the hardliners, as you said, trying to convince them that he's essentially one of them, thinks like they do. And so I think anyone expects there to be changes in policy is probably going to be disappointed. Will we see changes in tone? Is this somebody as a younger leader, somebody born after the revolution, will at least try to do things differently? We saw him when he was voting in Santa Clara last month in the National Assembly elections, come out and get in line and greet people and shake hands. He didn't come in with a big entourage. There wasn't a ton of security like you would see with Raul Castro. So, you know, he's waited 5 years to get to this point. Raul Castro made clear yesterday that he will eventually inherit the title of head of the Communist Party here, so he will have, within a few years, all the titles that Raul Castro has, and one assumes a lot more power, if not all the power that Raul Castro has. So what does he do with that? And that's, as of today, what we're waiting to see, if he does it any different at all.
Nora Gámez-Torres, let me ask you. Nora is joining us via Skype here on the Florida Roundup. Muted reaction. I mean, what were you able to pick up here on this side of the Florida Straits in terms of this moment of transition, but yet still having a Castro at the top of the Communist Party? The response amongst the South Floridian Cubans was what?
Hi, Tim. Yes, kind of the same that of the Cubans on the island. You know, it was received with the same sort of apathy and the belief that there's not going to come, that changes are not going to come in the short time. And it was interesting. There was not a lot of reaction here besides, you know, stating again and again after they have been saying for months now that it was not a real handover of power, that Raul Castro is, you know, the leader of the country. And Díaz-Canel himself, you know, he said it loud at the National Assembly that it was going to be Raul who's going to be taking the main decisions in the country. He said that in his first speech. So, like, Cuban exiles have been denouncing for, like, almost 5 years now that if actually Díaz-Canel inherit the title, he will not be inheriting the power.
So, Tim Padgett, with that in mind, what does the stage look like for Díaz-Canel? And what does it look like for Raul Castro as he, you know, apparently continues to obviously hold some strings with the president?
Well, there's the strange dynamic because Raul Castro himself has actually instituted some reform. in Cuba. Reform that in large measure has been opposed by his buddies in that revolutionary old guard.
In that front row that Patrick
described.
Exactly. Yeah.
And Diaz-Canel himself is kind of an acolyte of Raul in the sense that he himself agrees with that reform impulse that Raul has, at least economically, you know, to keep the island's economic head above water.
Yeah.
But he's going to be handcuffed. Let's say that he wants to try to open up the internet a little more on Cuba, because that is one of his impulses. He's an electrical engineer. He's a techno guy. He brings an iPad to meetings. Let's say he wants to open up the internet. But he's got guys like Ramiro Valdez, who's as old as Raul, and who hates the internet. He's called it one of the most dangerous instruments. In fact, he thinks it'll destroy the world, he was quoted as saying once. These are the guys that he's going to be up against when he tries to maneuver at all in areas like that.
So, Patrick, what about that? Especially on the economic side, the reforms that Raul Castro put in when he took over this title back, what was it?
2008,
when Fidel Castro dropped off kind of daily management, so to speak. Do those continue? I mean, they've slowed down somewhat, but do those continue under Diaz-Canel?
They've actually been completely frozen. If you want to open up a restaurant now in Cuba, if you want to open up a Casa Particular, these places that people rent out that become some of them quite nice and through Airbnb have done fantastically well, and actually we're competing with the Cuban government hotels, it's impossible. You can't get a license. The people who invested thousands of dollars of life savings to get ready to open one, and now they've waited now for over 6 months, and there's been no word. And that would be a very easy thing for Miguel Diaz-Canel to do, would unfreeze those licenses. And if he'd announced that yesterday, it would have caused some excitement. But there was nothing new in his speech in terms of policy, what he's going to do, his vision for the country. So the reforms at this point are as frozen as any time in the last 6 years that I've lived here, and we'll see if he has the power. I mean, like Tim was saying, it's hard to imagine Miguel Diaz-Canel saying, "No, Ramiro Valdez, I'm going to overrule you because I'm the president and you're the vice president." That doesn't work that way. So we are entering a new era. It's the first time in 40-some years where you have somebody, one name, not Castro, who's the head of state, but as well, you don't have one individual who is both the head of the party, head of the government, and head of the military. And so I think a lot of Cubans are wondering how this is all going to work. While Castro may, according to Diaz-Canel, be making all the decisions, but he's also said that he doesn't want to be, that he wants to turn over the day-to-day. He's 86 years old. He wants to not have to run the Cuban government, which is a tough job in any time, but particularly now with the U.S. relationship on the rocks, the economy not doing well, there are no easy answers for these guys.
I want to ask about the U.S. response here. Patrick Ottman is with us from Havana, CNN correspondent in Cuba. Patrick, hold on. Nora Gamas-Torres with the El Nuevo Herald and our partner, the Miami Herald. Tim Padgett with us here from WLRN. Let's go to the phones. Janir is joining us in Miami. Janir, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hey, I just wanted to say it's been a really tough week for us who have been here for a number of years. And, you know, the transition is just, another, I guess, a way of showing that there will be no change in Cuba for a really long time. And I'm just hopeful that, something changed at some point.
Janir, you can hear the emotion. Do you still have family on the island?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. And have you been able to talk to them over the past few days or so?
Yeah, we've talked to them. I mean, I think they're aware that nothing is really going to change. And I think for my dad, it's just a situation we've never. I mean, I came when I was four. We've never been back, and we're just hopeful that someday he'd get a chance to go back.
Janir, thank you for sharing your story with us here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Appreciate that. Nora, you hear the emotion, Janir, in Miami there. That is, I imagine, echoed and amplified across the Cuban exile community here, knowing that this transition does not represent a change. I think you used the word apathy, as a matter of fact, which may be among the most heartbreaking kinds of reactions, not meaning that you don't care, but that there is, again, a real a real display of hopelessness, of patience, of waiting, of hopelessness, of apathy, as you describe it.
And there's also, like, it's a deep sense of frustration of seeing how Raul actually managed to organize this, alleged transition, but really it was a secure transit, as he himself described it in his speech. He saw what happened to his brother, Raul, Fidel, and that I think that moment he thought that he would really need to organize, this handover in order to secure that the model they established, the socialist communist model, would continue after he dies. And also, like, just to pick up where team left it, about change and how, you know, if this canal would be able to actually introduce some changes in the economy. The thing is, like, everyone heard Raul complaining about, you know, like, the difficulty in introducing these changes and how the state bureaucracy itself was kind of, you know, one of the main obstacles he encountered. So it's going to be hard to see that this canal is going to be able to, you know, to make improvements in that area. Also, like, he said that he was not there to promise anything, but just, just to implement the changes already approved in the party. So we already know what are the sort of economic changes he would introduce. Also, like, I saw a draft of measures that allegedly are going to be announced soon at some point about, you know, private work. And there's some sort of simplification, you know, in the regulations. But at the same time, they're going to introduce restrictions on private work. For example, you were not going to be able to have, like, two restaurants. You will only be able to have one business. They're going to reduce the size of these private restaurants as well. So, I mean, I've been told that they've been waiting to announce these measures, but they are already agreed on. So, you know, in the short term, we would not expect a lot of changes, and some of those changes, you know, would not be positive.
Nora, let me bring Tim back into the conversation. Are we hearing anything at all from the State Department? Are we hearing anything at all from the diplomacy, the U.S. diplomacy, reduced as it is with Cuba, in regards to this transition?
No, I mean, you've got, you know, as I've written before, you've got a U.S. embassy in Havana now that's a glorified DMV. I mean, that's how threadbare, really, the staffing is because of this big spat over these alleged sonic attacks, et cetera. But underneath all of that, too, is just, I think, an impulse on the part of the Trump administration to roll back its own engagement, the U.S.'s engagement with Cuba, and which is kind of a shame because, you know, despite the fact, you know, that we've been talking about how it's going to be impossible for Díaz-Canel, et cetera, to really affect any change because the hardliners are still there. The one thing Díaz-Canel has on his side is biology, because these guys are all in their late 80s. Okay, and sure, in the short term, this is going to be really frustrating, but he does have time on his side that they don't have. And the thing to remember is that he and his generation of new leadership there do have some of Raul's, or a lot of, I would say, because they're his proteges, mm-hmm. a lot of his more pragmatic DNA. And once these dinosaurs start dying off, this generation of Díaz-Canel may find itself a little more able to execute that pragmatism. Let's hope.
And you heard from Janir, one of our callers earlier, about the real emotional patience that South Florida certainly has been feeling, as well as the rest of the exile community in the United States. Tim Padgett covering Cuba and the Americas for us here at WLRN. Nora Gámez-Torres doing the same for El Nuevo Herald and the Miami Herald. And Patrick Ottman, always great to have you on from Havana, the Cuba correspondent for CNN. Thanks so much to all three of you for joining us on the roundup today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've finally, on the roundup here, paying some tribute to the least poetic definition of where you live. We've been doing this here for the past several weeks, writing an ode to your zip code. We've been asking for your zip odes all month long, along with Oh Miami, and we have received thousands of poems.
Hello, my name is Maria Llorens. I live in Coconut Grove, and my zip code is 33129. This is my zip ode. Peacocks crossing streets, sirens blaring loud, crabs, abandoned museum, dog licking leftover Santero chicken feathers at the park.
Hi, my name's Kimberly. I live in Key West, and my zip code is 33040. And here's my zip ode. 2x4, conch train tour, road rage in paradise.
I'm Peter from Hollywood, 33024. No more cows grazing weedy fields. Now condos herd their tenants together.
My name is Naomi, and I live on Miami Beach. My zip code is 33140. First cold snap, no snow falls. Winter, iguanas dropping from trees.
Damn, I forgot how to say it in English. Hold up. I'm Melody Pendas, and that is my zip ode to Doral, Florida.
We will celebrate your odes to your zip codes Wednesday night next week at Vizcaya Museum and Gardens. You can find a link to that event. And you can still have a little bit of time here, at least on this Friday, to write your own zip ode. We've got a generator there for you online, wlrn.org/zip odes. That'll do it for the roundup this week. The program is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado, our digital director. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. Peter J. Meritz, our program chief. And our technical supervisor is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and listening. We'll see you and listen to you next week.